Hello, and welcome to the very first program of New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive people from East Timor, Hawaii, Afghanistan, and Fiji will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. People from a US state that wants to leave the Union, women dying to learn in Afghanistan, and how racism wrecks democracy in Fiji. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Kirsty Sord-Guzmal, First Lady of Timor-Leste, East Timor as some call it, and chairwoman of Alola, a foundation campaigning against violence toward Timor-Leste's women and children. Alola is the nickname of Juliana dos Santos, who, when just 15 years old, was kidnapped in East Timor by a militia leader during the September 1999 violence and taken to West Timor. Why did your foundation choose Juliana as the symbol of its work, Kirsty?
Well, back in 2001, when I sort of had newly returned to East Timor, obviously a whole range of issues and cases and needs were presented to me, even at that time when I wasn't yet First Lady of an independent East Timor, but simply the partner of one of the most significant people in the country, Juliana Guzmal. And I guess one of the stories that moved me most deeply was the story of Juliana when her parents came to visit me at my home in about March 2001 and told me about the circumstances in which she was taken, you know, brutally kidnapped and taken across the border by Egidio Manik, a militia leader, as a kind of war trophy. And as you can imagine, their absolute distress at having lost not only her but her 13-year-old brother, who was murdered by the same militia gang in September 99. The trauma, the distress that they experienced left a mark on me, probably because I'd just fairly recently, just a few months before, become a mother myself. So I really felt very deeply for Juliana's mother and resolved to try and do something, given limited resources and obviously limited power that I had to try and have her reunited with her family. So I went off to the United Nations Human Rights Commission with Juliana's aunt, who was by her side when she was kidnapped, and testified there and tried to, you know, just rally some political support from other countries in the region and indeed around the world to, you know, bring some pressure to bear on Indonesia for them to try and you know, get Egidio Manik to release his grasp upon her. And out of that experience of campaigning internationally for Juliana, I sort of became more interested broadly in the issues of sexual violence and gender-based violence experienced by women in Timor-Leste, not only during a time of upheaval and political crisis and chaos of the kind that we experienced in 1999 in this country, but also in peace times. And, you know, it became very evident to me that domestic violence and other forms of gender-based violence are pretty common experiences of women in this country.
Let's set the scene surrounding the time that Juliana was kidnapped. It's September 1999. In a vote overseen by the UN, East Timor has opted for independence from Indonesia, and within hours of that vote, pro-Indonesian militia swept through East Timor for months after that, wiped out independent supporters and vital infrastructure of the country. West Timor is still held by the Indonesians. What's the tension like between East and West today?
Well, as you're probably aware, Timor's leaders, including and perhaps particularly my husband, have pursued a very active policy of reconciliation and promotion of good, friendly, neighbourly relations with Indonesia, not only since independence, but since those very early days, back in late 1999. You know, November 99, we paid a visit already back to Jakarta when the wounds were still very fresh, to extend the olive branch to Indonesia. And I think, you know, that's a very important move politically. Obviously, you could say it's a pragmatic stance, given that we share a land border with Indonesia. We simply have to get along with them. But I think, you know, clearly Timorese over the years have established very close social, educational ties. You know, lots of Timorese were educated in Indonesia over the years, have formed friendships, relationships. You know, there's lots of intermarriage between Indonesians and East Timorese. And there are strong ties there that I think need to be nurtured for mutual gain, for mutual benefit. So there are no longer any tensions there, thankfully. Obviously, there are still a lot of unresolved issues, and
such as Juliana, such as Juliana's story,
such as Juliana, and I mean, of course, she's one of very, very many.
Yes, I can imagine it must be very difficult for Juliana now, and she is almost emblematic of the violence that is experienced by women in Timor. Now, as a result of her capture, she was pregnant, had a child, and is in West Timor now. She has family in both regions of the countries now, doesn't she? And so that must make it heartbreaking for her.
Yeah, she does.
Heartbreaking decisions.
You can imagine after that period of time in captivity, and I mean, essentially that's what it is, she's fallen victim to a whole range of psychological pressures, and I think she's probably a victim of Stockholm syndrome. Is probably experiencing that, and
which is what, Kirsty? What is?
It's basically where a victim starts to identify with their captor, and you know, rather than harbouring sentiments of hatred or anger towards them, actually comes to sympathise with them and with their cause. Now, in her case too, I think there's some economic reasoning. She's given birth to two of his children by now. She obviously has their best interests and their survival in mind too when she's considering her options for the future. Her parents are as poor as church mice, have barely a roof over their heads in Swai where they live. She's probably wondering, you know, what are my prospects if I go back to East Timor? Am I not better off, you know, living in a situation of literally captivity with this man, but at least I know where my next meal is coming from and that I'm able to clothe and educate my kids.
Oh. Of course, East Timor's not alone here. Many countries collapse into violence after their invading rulers get up and leave. I suppose that once people from other countries are imported by colonial rulers into a country, the racial mix can get messed up with drastic consequences for government later on. So Indonesia imported Indonesians into East Timor after they took over in 1975. And now that Indonesia's gone, the Indonesian sympathisers and East Timorese have had to fight it out. Britain imported Indians during their rule over Fiji, and now the Fijian Indians and the indigenous Fijians are still jockeying amongst themselves for appropriate representation in government and land. Let's go to Fiji now to look at how this played out in the military coup here last December. Dr. Shaista Shamim is director of the Fiji Human Rights Commission, which, by the way, is the first commission of its kind in the Pacific Islands. There's been four coups, military takeovers, in Fiji in the last two decades. Can you describe the central racial tension between them for us, Shaista?
I think that one has to be really careful about this concept of ethnic tension sometimes, because you know the assumption is that you would have, you know, you throw a couple of ethnic groups together and it's inevitable because of cultural differences or whatever that you would have some kind of tension between the groups. But quite often, you know, with colonialism operating in the way that it has done, especially British colonialism, I don't know how it worked out in East Timor because it was a different format, but certainly British colonialism, we had different roles spelled out for different ethnic groups. And in Fiji's case, it used to be called the three-legged stool. And the three legs were Fijian land, Indian labour, and European money. The British colonial system actually kept all the three legs separate, but somehow harmoniously interacting with each other during colonialism, but that doesn't necessarily spell out as harmoniously as before after independence. And I think that really has not properly been analysed in Fiji and obviously in other colonies similar to Fiji.
I suppose that after Indians were imported to prop up your sugar industry, the breakdown in population of Indians who stayed on is tipping, is it 50% now of the population so that you have... We've just got a very screechy sound on the phone. I'm not quite sure what it is.
No. Oh, that's probably coming from my end. Chris, the power has just died here and all the UPSs in the office are going haywire.
That sounds like us over the last few days, so I don't know how long we can hold out.
It's
a daily occurrence.
I can imagine. And one of the problems for us in this program, because we hope to bring in voices from places in the world which don't often get heard because of this very thing, that their communication and technology difficulties that make those voices getting out into the world difficult.
Mm. Yeah.
Just going back to that question, I suppose... One of the legacies of British rule in Fiji, Shayesta, is that the Indian population behind has grown to almost 50% of the population of Fiji. Is that right?
Well, it was 50%, in fact 49%, before the 1987 coup. And then, of course, after the coup, when there were widespread implementation of racial discrimination, there's no other way of putting it, really. And after that, of course, people started leaving in droves, or, you know, either migrating, and there was a huge brain drain to Australia and New Zealand mostly, but also to places like Canada and the United States. And so there is some suggestion that it's now about 35%. Indian.
The first Indian to be elected as Prime Minister in Fiji was overthrown by a military coup, and so was the second. But this time around, the military seems to be doing the opposite, reacting against an anti-Indian government. Tell us about the Garissa government's hate propaganda, as you say in the report, and their land reform policies that seem to undermine the place of Indians in Fiji society.
I think that probably most people see the four coups, five coups, you know, we've lost count now, to be honest.
That's a terrible indictment.
As sort of underpinned by, you know, ethnic tensions and so on. The government throughout, especially the government ministers and the members of parliament, used parliamentary privilege to make really obnoxious, objectionable and unconstitutional remarks about the Indian population. Some of them you wouldn't imagine that people would still, you know, have the capacity to say in this day and age, because, I mean, these are remarks that sort of Hitler used to make before the Second World War, you know, about the Jewish people. But because they were done under cover of parliamentary privilege, there was not a lot an institution like the Human Rights Commission could do. You know, those people are protected. So really, if it had been said on the street or anywhere else, we would have prosecuted those people straight away. But we couldn't because they were in parliament. So that was one problem. I mean, it was just the verbal messages that people in Fiji got, you know, that Indians behave in this way or they stink. And then the other problem we had was just the policies that were being formulated by the Garissa government. That would have actually stopped not just the Indo-Fijian population, but also 50% or more of the population of Fiji from having access to coastal areas unless, you know, some other conditions were met. And they're just horrendous pieces of legislation. So I think that, you know, apart from the racial speeches and the legislation, there was also a policy, an affirmative action policy that was put in place by the same government. The constitution says that you can have an affirmative action policy for people who are disadvantaged in society, and it doesn't say it's race-based or anything. And what the government was doing in Fiji was highlighting only Indigenous Fijian people as being disadvantaged. And so that particular policy was investigated by the Human Rights Commission at the beginning of, well, it took 2 years for us to investigate because the government ministers and government departments weren't forthcoming with some of the documents we were seeking. But we finally did manage to get that report out at the beginning of last year, 2006, and basically showed that not only was that particular policy against Section 38 of our Constitution, which protects people from unfair discrimination, but also against Fiji's obligations in international law under the CERD convention, you know, which we have ratified.
The Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination.
That's right. So it's not as though, you know, it's just something that we're talking just, you know, yesterday's events. It's been going on for quite some time.
There's been four coups. The last one, which effectively swept in the Garissa government, has been held by your courts to be unconstitutional. Your courts will soon be determining whether this current coup is constitutional. So the rule of law is still very much alive and kicking in Fiji. However, even if this current coup isn't legal, A recent report done by you and the Fiji Human Rights Commission, Shaista, says that the Garissa government wasn't constitutionally elected and therefore, assumedly, hasn't any legal legitimacy. So what are the consequences of this for Fiji? The fact that the Garissa government wasn't constitutionally elected, what will happen now, do you think?
Oh, well, first of all, they're going to have to, decide on whether or not any legal challenges will be issued to the current interim government. But on the other hand, I suspect it might just be of academic interest because a new interim government has now been put in place and there's only one, I think, minister outstanding. So I think, the interest should be in the next few weeks rather than what's happened in the immediate past now.
Kirsty Sulguzmal, Timor-Leste, where many Indonesians chose to remain in the country after the Indonesian government left. Are some of the things that Shaista is talking about ringing bells for you in terms of how that interaction is panning out?
You referred to sort of racial tensions before and Indonesian sympathisers sort of fighting it out with other Timorese. I really don't think that's been actually a phenomenon here in Timor. There were Indonesians that remained in the country at the end of 1999, but they tended to be civilian people rather than military people, people that, had established long-term bonds with this country and wanted to continue to be here. There were very few cases of tensions between Timorese and Indonesians, in the early years after the Indonesians departed, which is quite extraordinary. I think reflects very positively on the political maturity of the Timorese. They were able to distinguish between the acts of the military and the brutality that was meted out to them by the Indonesian military and ordinary Indonesians who they recognised as being just as much victims of a regime and its successes as they themselves were as Timorese.
I'm wondering if, given the violence that was perpetuated by the pro-Indonesian militias in East Timor, whether or not any of that has rubbed off on the way in which the Indonesians now in your country are treated.
I think, obviously, there are tensions. There's a great deal of trauma as well, clearly, given the level of the violence and just the way it affected just every section of this society. I don't think there's a single family that's been untouched by the violence. I don't think that there's been any active discrimination against Indonesian nationalists or even really against people who were pro-Indonesian. The person who was the spy for the Indonesian police who used to keep an eye on foreigners who visited Timor in the 1990s, including myself, is now the head of immigration. A lot of people that actually benefited from collaborating with the Indonesians are ironically some of the people with the greatest skills and therefore the greatest to offer in a period of independence, because they were accorded opportunities for training, for gaining experience in management in other areas. So ironically, they are, in some cases, people who are now occupying fairly senior positions within government and within broader civil society organisations.
That's a wonderful story. It's almost, if you embrace the problem and place people in an equal footing, you have a much better chance of things. And that must be, Shaista, what your commission is aiming for too.
I think it's almost like saying, okay, let's go back to 87 and we should have gone down this particular path and we didn't. And now look, we've had to band-aid over a lot of the difficulties. You know how it is when you accommodate. I mean, I'm sure Kirsty would have experienced something like this when it's really, really bad. And instead of saying, oh, I'm going to sit down and give up, or I'm going to migrate or go and live on an island, you're actually having to kind of accommodate, certain disadvantages or certain things that are going on just so that you can get on in society and you can get on with the next door neighbours and so on. So since 87, a lot of people are just making those accommodations and kind of, just cringing every time ethnic politics raises its ugly head. But it feels as though, even though, the legality of a military takeover and all these issues still have to be decided, it feels to most people that we're going back to 87 and attempting to kind of straighten things out so that, every person in this country country, no matter what ethnic group and whatever race or, you know, whatever religion or whatever it is going to have a fair chance. I think that's all that people want.
Shaista Shamim, great to talk with you. We're going to say goodbye to Shaista now because Hanani K. Trask from Hawaii has just dropped in. But Shaista's going to join us again in 2 weeks as a co-host in this program. We're looking forward to it already, Shaista.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris.
Going now from the South Pacific to the North Pacific, our next guest is in Hawaii. Hanani K. Trask is an Indigenous human rights advocate, scholar, and a wordsmith and poet. With an estimated 90% of human languages becoming extinct during this century, people like Hanani are making sure that Hawaiian won't be one of them. Aloha.
Aloha.
It's estimated that over half of the world's 6,000 languages will not survive our children's generation. I bet when you and your mum were learning English in school, it felt like the Hawaiian language was heading for extinction too.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, my mother was a native speaker, and then by the time she went to school, the language had already been banned. She had one of those terrible experiences where you learn English in the school, but you speak Hawaiian at home. So when she went to school as a very young child, the language was English. And she was a native speaker, so, of course, it was capital punishment, as we say now. You know, they had little rulers that rapped on their knuckles if they spoke Hawaiian, and after a certain amount of time, of course, they didn't. And then she would have the complication of going back to her own house with 10 other children and her mother and speaking Hawaiian all the time. So that was their experience, and by the time she left the island she was born and raised on, for the island of Oahu, where Honolulu is, she had lost her facility completely. And then she went to college there and, you know,
so what
lived
about
the rest of her life as a non-native speaker.
So in your household, you were speaking English as you were growing up?
Yes.
And what about at school?
We only spoke English. And in fact, I never heard Hawaiian until it was officially made one of the two languages of the state of Hawaii. And then they began teaching it to young children in immersion schools, which we learned, by the way, from the Maori. And now all my nieces and nephews are fluent in Hawaiian.
Yeah.
So the language came back very quickly.
I'm really interested in exploring that. But before I do, some would say that maybe we should all speak one language so that people can understand each other better. What do you think?
Well, I think the question isn't one language. The question is many languages. And the tolerance that we should give to the great creativity of other people, which is to respect their customs and their language.
And why do you think, in your experience, that's important? For instance, do you think differently from North Americans just because you speak a different language, and is that important?
Absolutely.
Why?
And that's the great gift of language. For example, my favorite quote for people is that land in the American language, American meaning, is called real estate, that which produces profit. Whereas in the Hawaiian language, land is called aina, that which feeds.
Mm.
Now, that's a perfect example of the difference.
Yes, so one's linked to your connection with the land and the earth,
yes,
and your environment,
exactly,
and the other's not.
Yep, and one tells you about reproduction of profit, and the other tells you about the reproduction of food. Those are two very different things. You know, it's a kind of badge of imperialists that they ban the language. Part of their control is the control of your mind, and one way to control it is to take away the words you have for your own culture and your own people and supplant it with foreign words that don't match, that don't fit. You know, you have a schizophrenic relationship with your own people because you can't speak to each other in your own language. And it goes on from there. I mean, we don't have a word, for example, for adoption. And when the missionaries came, they were appalled that Hawaiians had any number of children from other people that they took care of. So they invented this word. And we don't say that children are adopted. We say that we hanai them, meaning if it's not the child of your body, your kino, your body, then it's the child of hanai. And hanai means to feed. You feed the child, and therefore it's part of you.
Mm.
The other thing is that we share children. So many children can belong to many families, even though under American law that's not possible. Under everyday practice, of course it is.
What difference does that make to you as a society?
It's tremendous, because the Hawaiian system of to feed, which now is called technically adoption, has to be, from the American point of view, put down in writing, and you have to say who gets to inherit and who, at the age of majority, who can say whether you will live with this person or that person. It complicates not only your worldview, but it sunders the sense of family. Family is quite large in Hawaii, whereas the American way is parents and children. And that's not our way. So it's a problem.
Yes. And I suppose that in terms of the way you view yourself as a society, what you see on a TV screen or a film coming out of America is quite different to the types of concepts you're talking about.
Yes. And also just the whole expression of feelings, the relationship between people that are also of the land, so that many of us have been adopted by different groups of people, American Indians, the Maori, and we don't think of that as being strange. And I think part of the problem is that the world that we now live in, it doesn't have the same kind of generosity of spirit or generosity of taking care of other people. It's more very individualistic, and that's a problem for all Native people. Being individual in Native culture is a bad thing. Everybody respects individual capacities, but you're supposed to have certain group values.
Wow, no wonder that people in Hawaii think that perhaps they are different from the United States, if that's
yes.
the case.
Yes, and of course, you know, one of the great things about us is that now that our language is legal again, people are speaking it, especially the younger generation, and that, you know, it appalls people that we just don't speak English. They get very upset by it.
What do you mean legal? It was illegal to speak Hawaiian
yes.
at one stage.
Yes, it was banned from all schools and books, and you couldn't go to school as a child and speak Hawaiian. You had to speak English. So, you know, it was very rigidly enforced, as it is all over the world with banned languages. And once it was unbanned, then it became, you know, a fad. Even non-Hawaiians wanted to learn it.
So what's revived the language?
A political movement, which was my generation's doing, which brought back into focus for the general public the overthrow in 1893, the banning of the language. And then that went on for 10, 15 years with land occupations and people being imprisoned. In fact, we lost a couple of people, more probably, through drownings and, you know, suicides. And it was a very painful era. And out of that era came the joys that we now celebrate with the next generation, which is the consciousness that being Hawaiian is something to be proud of, that we have the longest history of any of the ethnic groups in Hawaii, in fact, 2,000-plus years here, that we know how to take care of our land, and they don't, that we don't believe in making a profit at other people's expense. I mean, the cultural revival is wonderful. I'm 57, and all my nephews and nieces speak Hawaiian. And I never would have imagined that my generation would have opened the door for that. And we did.
So what's the reaction of young people? You'd think that young people living in the United States, because Hawaii is part of the United States, would perhaps turn their back on something that didn't appear to be mainstream culture. That's not the case.
No, it's not the case, in part because of this romanticization of Hawaii. Everyone thinks when I'm traveling, and I say that I come from Hawaii, and of course now we have 6.5 million tourists a year. So everybody says, oh, you come from Hawaii, I was there for vacations. So we don't have that kind of dislike that people would normally have for, especially the Americans, for another country, for people from another country. They don't think of us as primitive, they think of us as exotic. And that's really what the tourist trade, you know, flourishes on, is the exoticism of the natives and the land and surfing and dancing, and, you know, it's a commercial aspect of what happened.
I was in China recently, and the Chinese were telling me how exotic the Canadians were. I wonder whether difference is exotic in itself.
Well, the good thing about the Chinese, congratulations to them, is that they run their own country. The problem with us is that we don't run our country. So the tourist industry is not run by Hawaiians.
Hawaii was invaded by English speakers, first the British and then the United States.
Yes.
Just briefly, can you give us a quick overview of why the U.S. took over Hawaii?
Yes. If you look at a map of Hawaii, we are strategically located in the North Pacific. When the United States set out from its shores to conquer the rest of the world, which of course we all know they have done at this point, they needed bases. And so the Pacific became the American lake. Put bases on every single island, which is what we have now. So we have bases in Hawaii, the biggest military base in the United States for the naval station is here. It's called Pearl Harbor. And then if you look at Guam, they have one of the biggest air bases to lift people out of and into Asia. And Guam is about 2,000 miles in the South Pacific from where we are in the North Pacific. And then you look at, you know, Tinian and all the rest of the little tiny places where the U.S. wants to do, like the French did in Tahiti, more kinds of experiments. And pretty soon you see the value of Hawaii for the government of the United States. Imperialism needs, you know, needs land, and tourists, they just need a vacation. So those are the two sort of economic pins that keep us down. One is militarism and the other one is tourism.
And do you think that the fact that the history of Hawaii is written by English-speaking academics has any bearing on Hawaii's place in the world at the moment?
Well, not only does it have a great deal of bearing on it, but the fighting that goes on between what passes for history. To this day, the history that lots and lots of people think is the best history was written by someone who did not know the Hawaiian language. So, I mean, how can you write a history of a country when you don't know their language? And that has now been one of the focuses of my generation, which is to educate our young people in the language and to get them to rewrite the history, which they're doing.
Hanani, Kirsty Sword Guzmão is also on the line from Timor-Leste. Timor-Leste has been under Portuguese rule for over a century, then occupied by Indonesia for over two decades. I can imagine that language must have been a contentious debate within Timor-Leste since it's got its independence, Kirsty.
What's my experience?
It's certainly an extremely complex linguistic scenario here in Timor. We have 16 indigenous languages across this small half island. We then have an overlay of Portuguese, which was, of course, the language of the colonial power for 500 years. We then have, you know, another overlay of Bahasa Indonesia, the national language of Indonesia, as the sort of occupying country for 25 years. I think very similarly to the situation in Hawaii during that period of Indonesian occupation, use of all of the indigenous languages, including the lingua franca, Tetum, which is one of those indigenous languages, was not legally banned, but it was certainly not encouraged, as was Portuguese. Portuguese was also actively discouraged by the Indonesians because Portuguese was associated with resistance to Indonesian rule. And as a consequence, you know, people would deliberately make use of Portuguese as a way of making a statement and taking a stand against the Indonesians. Obviously, today, in an era of independence, we've had some very difficult decisions to make. Portuguese has been adopted as the official language, and that's one that has not sat well with certain sections of the society, particularly young people who have been educated in Indonesia and who feel much more familiar, actually, with the Indonesian language and more able to express themselves in both verbal and written form. It's nevertheless a decision that has been taken, for better or for worse. We now, of course, are also facing the problem of where do these 16 indigenous languages sit within that. Tetum, the lingua franca, has also been adopted as a second official language, but because it wasn't encouraged during the period of Indonesian occupation, nor was it really actively used or promoted in Portuguese times, very few people actually feel able to express themselves adequately in the language. And it's not a well-developed language in terms of its scientific and technological terminology. So there's a long way to go in terms of developing the language and, you know, just development of people's capacity to use the language. It's going to take some time before, obviously, Tetum gains its rightful place. in the new nation.
I'm wondering if there are any communication problems being experienced by the children who are speaking Portuguese when their parents don't understand the language, if they've been speaking Indonesian. Is there a problem in the country at the moment in this transition?
Certainly there is. I mean, just about every meeting that takes place across this country, whether it's a meeting at government level or with an NGO such as, you know, Maya Lola Foundation,
yes,
probably about the first 5 minutes of every meeting is taken up with actually coming to some consensus as to what language the meeting will be conducted in. As you can imagine, you know, you have people with a smattering of Portuguese, but they may feel more confident with Indonesian. You have others who perhaps don't speak Tetum. There are certain parts of the country where people, you know, have had no experience of speaking or writing Tetum, and they speak only another indigenous language. So in that case, you might opt for Indonesian if they have received an education in Indonesian times. Obviously, we don't yet have a young generation of people who are speaking Portuguese fluently to the exclusion of other languages. Presumably, that point will come in the near future, but it certainly hasn't happened as yet. But you do have young people who are going into school and who are being encouraged to speak Portuguese and to learn Portuguese, and are feeling it somewhat of a handicap and a disadvantage because of never having spoken the language, never having used it in any context in their daily life. But I guess, you know, even if English had been adopted as a national language, we would have had to face those same sharp learning curves as well. You know, I guess it's a generational thing. As I mentioned before, many young people have been educated in Indonesia, have had little or no experience of speaking or writing Portuguese, and fear that this will discriminate against them, particularly in the workplace and vying for jobs on the employment market. And understandably, they're feeling that, well, you know, if Indonesian had been adopted as the national language, I would have had a better chance.
So the young students would have a go at jobs in Indonesia, which has a population of 220 million people and an economy that equates with that, as compared to East Timor. I suppose the same must be happening in Hawaii as well, a small population, where students can speak Hawaiian, but will their job prospects be limited later down the track if they're looking at the United States as a potential market to get a job?
Yes, that's correct. And we have now the great joy of saying that my generation brought back the language into usage, but more and more tourists come here and settle, and Hawaiians out-migrate to greener pastures, so to speak. As I say, all my brothers and sisters' children all speak Hawaiian, so they're now bilingual. And that was a great gift that my generation gave to the next generation. I wish I could have given them land, but at least they know now what land means in their own language.
Hanani Keitresk, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thank you very much. And I'm very proud to have shared this with, is it Christy?
Christy, yeah.
Yes, congratulations. You know, you really deserve it. It was a long struggle, and it's marvelous to see the victory, no matter how much work has yet to be done. Please tell your husband that whole struggle has really buoyed our people. We look to all the successes in the Pacific for hope.
Yeah.
So please convey that to him, because
yeah,
I'm very proud to have shared this moment.
Certainly,
with you.
Certainly will. Thank you for your solidarity.
Yes.
Aloha, Hanani. And will you come back on the program soon to read some of your favourite poetry?
Whenever you're interested, I'm here.
And speaking of Pacific poetry, here's today's feature song. Thank you. Debussy à la Réunion, played by René Lassalle and Bob Brosman on the Dig Dig album. You're listening to New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Radio 3CR studios in Australia with today's co-host, Kirsty Sword-Gusmao, who's chatting with us through a mobile phone in Timor-Leste. Women may be well represented in our radio program today, but not, so it seems, in Afghanistan. How many times did you hear that one of the main benefits for the international invasion of Afghanistan would be greater freedom for women? Yet according to our next guest, Alia, who's from the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, 5 years since that invasion, life has never been so bad. Alia went with a judge into an Afghani hospital recently to investigate why women were setting fire to themselves. What did the young women tell you, Alia?
1 year before, I went with a journalist. We had a research on the women who are burning themselves, and we have interviewed 15, 20 women, and the reasons behind that incident is most of the forced marriages, and they are not happy with the husband. It means that the husband tortured them, beat them, and they have, it's domestic violence, because of domestic violence, most of the cases. And the main problem is that they explain that there's no any other option for us. The kind of government we have, the kind of system we have, the laws are all corrupt. They don't do anything for us. If we go to women's rights, to different NGOs that are working in Afghanistan, they are just for show. They don't do anything for women in practical. Mm. That's why nobody hears our voices. That's why we put fire. We burn themselves. That's the only way, and that's the only option left for us. Yeah, I met a girl who was only 12 years old. She was 1 month pregnant, and she was, because of domestic violence, she put fire, she burned herself, and she was just a kid. And she was crying that I'm dying. And when we talked with her, she said, I couldn't find any other way.
So 1,000 cases in one province of young people burning themselves. You said yes. Forced marriages was one of the reasons for that, that young people were being forced against their will into marriages. How does it work in your country? Why do forced marriages come about?
There are, again, different reasons. First of all, Afghanistan being a Muslim country, and it's still a backward country. That's why RAW was established before war in 1977, just to work for the women's rights in Afghanistan, to make the women of Afghanistan aware, and to make the people of Afghanistan, not only women, the men of Afghanistan, aware of their rights, basic rights. Because women in Afghanistan, even before war, they didn't have, in most provinces, even their basic rights. And marriage is a basic right, which is still our women don't enjoy. And they don't have the choice in most provinces, especially in villages like west of Afghanistan. They don't have the right to marry with whom they want.
Yes.
And the marriages mostly start from age of 9. It starts from age of 9, which they are just a kid. When they go to, they have to accept, because they don't have any choice to, agree or not agree with the partner or with the husband they will have in future. They have to accept whatever their parents ask them. But not only the marriages, there are different other reasons. Like there are lots of university students, girls in Herat and other provinces. They are, because they have the awareness, they are aware of their rights. But that's why they don't accept the kind of life they have, the pressures they have in the family, because of the father and mostly because of the husband. That's why they put fight. And on the most important is that there's nobody to help them.
Yes. I understand, too, that because of the poverty in some of the regions of Afghanistan, the dowries are quite large for the young girls, and therefore there is the importance of money being a factor too for the families of the brides.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because even yesterday night I read a report that a father who has 5 daughters, and he sold one of his daughter who was only 12 years old. He said because of poverty, because I don't have money, and that's why I want to marry my daughter. And all the other 4 who are 9 years old, he said, I will also marry these 4, just because I don't have enough money and I don't have anything to feed them.
I'm wondering what the effect of that is, that if you're buying and selling young girls, does it mean that the young girls just become commodities to the people who are buying them rather than people?
Yeah, like that's one case. Like they sell the daughter at the age of 12 and just because of poverty. But there are lots of families in the villages of Afghanistan that still they have the same tradition. They sell their daughter. They are not because of poverty. They are just they think it's the tradition, and because they don't think women as a human being, they just sell them. They just give money and they steal their daughter, and that's why the family of the daughter, in most of the cases, they don't behave as a human being with them. They don't consider them as a human being. They consider them as their property.
Alia, your present parliament is dominated by the Northern Alliance. The way the Northern Alliance treated women between 1992 and 1996 in Afghanistan was arguably worse than when the Taliban started ruling your country in 1996. Why do the Taliban and the Northern Alliance think they can treat women so badly?
It's because there are different reasons. The most important reason is that the kind of environment they've grown up. And they only taught Quranic and Islamic teachings, and the mullahs and their teachers teach them Islamic teachings, but not in the correct way. They have the most backward, the most inhuman, the most anti-woman interpretation of Quran and Islamic rules. And whatever they did in Afghanistan against women, they just use Quran as their justification. And the other important reason, which I think is very important, is because they are afraid. These fundamentalists are afraid of the movement, of the uprising of the women, because women is 50% of the population of Afghanistan, and they want this 50% of the society not to wake up, not to get awareness. That's why they put them in the houses, so that make them silent. The women of Afghanistan, most of them, the educated ones, especially the teachers, they played a very important role in those years of Taliban.
I was reading recently about, in some of the more remote areas of Afghanistan, some of the teachers who were trying to teach young girls were getting tortured when they were found out. What's that about, Alia?
Yeah, that's true. That's what I want to say, because in all provinces of Afghanistan, these the commanders, the governors, these are all these fundamentalists. The Northern Alliance leaders are commanders who ruled Afghanistan before Taliban. And that's what we want to say to the world, that there's no change, because we have the same fundamentalists, maybe Taliban, maybe Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, and they are anti-women.
Yes.
They don't like women's education, and it's a kind of pressure for them. That's why they burn schools in villages, in provinces. They kidnap, they rape school-going girls. We should first bring change in the political system. Then we can bring change in the education system and all other. We can provide security for women and for all the people.
That was Alia, a spokesperson for the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, speaking from safety in neighbouring Pakistan. Thanks for joining us today, Alia.
Thanks a lot. On behalf of Rawa, I would like to thank your radio for giving us time, because it's good for us, so that the world should know about the situation or what's going on in Afghanistan.
All the best to you, Alia. You obviously have a very difficult struggle, and you have the solidarity and the friendship of the women of East Timor.
Yeah, and not only East Timor, but all the women all around the world. We know that our struggle is very...
Of course,
it's very difficult and risky, but we are happy that we have people like you around us, and that gives us energy and strength.
Kirsty Sood-Guzmao, a new nation has truckloads of different priorities, some of them competing. Where does education figure on your country's agenda?
Look, I think nobody disputes that education is extremely important. In fact, there was a national consultation that was done back in about 2001, 2002, a process that was led by my husband, which was basically food or input for our national development plan. So there were groups of people, teams of people that went across the country and asked the people themselves, what are your own priorities? And certainly education figured very, very highly on that list. I guess, you know, that's reflected in the health and education budgets, which are, you know, amongst the the heftiest of the national budget, which is a good thing. Nobody disputes, though, that the challenges are enormous. 80 to 90% of our public and private infrastructure was destroyed in 1999, and that included schools. Also, the vast majority of our teaching professionals, both secondary and primary, left the country in 1999, since most of them were Indonesian nationals. So we're not only in a position of having to build up basic infrastructure once again from the ground up, but we're also having to train a teaching core, which, you know, as you can imagine, doesn't happen overnight.
Absolutely. And I'm wondering, what did your population say about education? They said it was a priority, but how high was it compared to, say, for instance, the building of hospitals, the building of roads, the building of other basic infrastructure that East Timor needs to become a nation?
Well, the people rated it as number one. Obviously, you know, as you quite rightly pointed out, there are a whole range of priorities, and it's hard to hone in on any particular ones as being the ones that are more deserving of, you know, financial assistance and attention from government and from elsewhere. But certainly in the people's view, education was number one. I guess that reflects on the wisdom of the people, really, because, you know, essentially education is the key to so much. You can have fantastic roads, you can have bridges, you can have schools, but if you don't have trained teachers to be teaching in them, if you don't have young people with a basic education to be the future doctors and leaders of the country, then one doesn't hold out great hopes for the future.
Okay, well, that's it from today's New Internationalist. Join us same time, same place on the dial next week when campaigners from Bolivia, the Netherlands, Nova Scotia and England are planning to drop in for a chat. A big thank you to our studio producer, Rachel Maher, who's done some great technical work to get this program to air. Thanks too to New Internationalist guest Kirsty Sword Guzmar, First Lady of Timor-Leste and activist for East Timor. We hope you can drop in for a chat with us again very soon, Kirsty.
That'd be my pleasure and my privilege. Thank you.
All the best and thank you for joining us. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. In the coming weeks, we'll be featuring albums from their Riverboat Records series, a different album every week. This week's musical interludes are from Rene LaSalle and Bob Brosman's fabulous album, Dig Dig, where the pulse of the Pacific melts into the arms of bluegrass and Latin. You'll find them on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. You'll also find copies of this program on the New Internationalist website, just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. I'm Chris Richards. Thanks for joining us, and talk with you again next week.